Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and I'm now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Rob DeVos for a conversation on education infrastructure in Australia. We'll explore what social infrastructure and education infrastructure are, with a focus on the early learning or pre-K segment. We'll also explore the value proposition of education infrastructure to, on the one hand, education groups, and on the other hand, investors. Rob is a seasoned property and financial markets executive with over 25 years' experience. He is the CEO and managing director of Arena REIT, a social infrastructure investment firm founded in 2003 and listed on the Australian Securities Exchange, or ASX, since 2013. Arena owns 289 properties, of which 279 are for education and 10 are for healthcare. The portfolio is valued at roughly 1.7 billion Australian dollars, which is approximately 1.1 billion US dollars. Arena has delivered strongly for investors. From listing in 2013 to 2024, Arena has delivered close to an 18% annualized return compared to just over 9% for the ASX. And that return has had both a healthy yield as well as share price appreciation. Rob, it's great to have you on. Welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much, Mondi. Very kind introduction. Look forward to the discussion.
Thanks, Rob. As we start, before we get into social infrastructure and education infrastructure, I'd first love to learn a bit about you. So please tell us a bit about your journey. Where did you grow up? Sure. A little bit about your family and ultimately your path to social infrastructure and education.
Thanks, Mondi. So I'm a Melbourne born and bred. I was raised in a small farming community about 3 hours east of Melbourne. My early education journey was a small faith-based school of about 40 students in a small village called Warburton. We had about three teachers teaching 40-odd students there, Mondi. So very humble beginnings from an education perspective. What we had, a hell of a lot of care that sat around that community and a lot of encouragement. So what have we lacked in scale, we certainly made up for in community care and encouragement. And I guess that sort of stuck with me for some time. Like most children that grew up in that area, strived not much more than to work on the local apple farm. So I did that for a little while and was fortunate enough to be taken away from there from a family friend who realised me hanging around the farm perhaps might not be the greatest use of my time as I grew older. So at about 19 or 20 years of age, I came back into Melbourne to pursue a corporate career. I started at a very low administrative role at one of the large accounting firms and quickly realised that education was quite an important part of not only just progressing a career, but finding out who I was and what I wanted to do into the future. So I guess that meant a lot of night schooling, working my way through up a large organisation, finding that I really loved real estate, following some qualifications in real estate. I learned that to do that well, you really needed some finance qualifications and learn a bit about finance. So did some of that and more latterly into social impact and learning how to manage that amongst leadership and strategy. Strategy courses through the journey, Mondi. So, look, probably not an orthodox way in which to find a CEO of an ASX company, but one that's given me great grounding, I think, and one that has, I guess, true to the ethos of us looking after social impact or being interested and engaged and wanting to do the best for communities, starting from a small community actually really helped.
That's very, very interesting. That was a whirlwind tour across, many decades of your life. So that's great. Yeah, I'd love to double click on a few of those areas. I'd love to hear a little bit more about growing up in a farming community. When I think of farming, sure. I think of extraordinary work ethic, waking up really early in the morning often. I'd love to hear a bit about what it was like growing up in a farming community.
That's no doubt about that. It's an interesting, you know, there's that part of what's now called the Yarra Valley, or the Upper Yarra Valley, has moved from very much a blue collar into more gentrified times these days. But going back sort of 40 years ago, times were relatively tough. You know, it was, a hard farming and primary produce was hard to put food on the table for many families. We had a single mother that was looking after me. So getting out and working pretty early on school holidays was an important part of what our family was about. We're a small family. We had three of us, mum, my sister and I, and all of us have got a pretty strong work ethic. It's not lost on me that mum went through a similar journey a bit later when coming off the farm with sick grandparents a bit later in life. She went off and did late education, became master's qualified. So she too had an amazing influence on my life. But education and getting out of communities that really didn't have a lot of money back then, you know, education was a very big part of that. So, wonderful to be talking about education today in that context of that journey. But I see it not just for myself, but from a number of people that have come through, you know, those communities in not just regional Victoria and outside of Melbourne, but across Australia, indeed, in many parts of the world.
That's wonderful. And I'm interested also in the night schooling experience while we're still here on your path. So how was that? How was working at night school? Was this distance, or were you actually going in the evenings to class?
I was going in on the evenings. It was predated any technology that allowed remote learning, unfortunately, Mondi. So it was literally, sort of missing out on dinner and working the full day and then going at night schooling. And I've got to say, it opened up my eyes. You know, it was a period of my life. There's a lot of energy, a lot of new learning, and a lot of excitement and really collegiate nature. I think one of the great things, and we'll talk about this more in our discussion, but one of the great things about education, not only receiving it but actually providing, facilitating access to it, is the collegiality. And I certainly got a lot of that. A lot of peers that I've become, have networked with over time, and have created value for other stakeholders as a result of those late nights working around what an internal rate of return meant, all those types of fun things, Mondi. So a wonderful experience, wouldn't take it back. A good investment of time for me personally.
Okay. And just my final question on you before we get to social and education infrastructure, just to follow you down that path. So one of the things that attracted you to education and has kept you there is the culture and the collegiality that you just alluded to. Give me a bit more color. What originally attracted you to education and has kept you in there?
I think it was the sparkle of just realising just how big the world is. Again, from an upbringing that was relatively sheltered to see, and I remember coming in first day of working for one of the large accounting firms at the lowest role, and seeing all these wonderful suits and shiny shoes and taking a view of just what I didn't know, and the excitement of sort of starting to learn to understand what others were doing, and I guess the role of commerce and what it could do. So I found it a wonderful, both the finance and real estate side of my career, and being able to join the two of those, a wonderful community of individuals. And then when you apply that to what our business does and has been doing for the last 20 years in social infrastructure, and particularly around education, it really is a win-win. You've got wonderful long-term impacts for those that are undertaking that. You've got a balance between what governments want to provide to communities. You're ticking the community's positive social impact box. All things that, as a practitioner, as a provider of accommodation, take great pride in. So, it's been a wonderful journey, and lots of wonderful characters that have helped helped me and the industry grow from that perspective.
That's great. And your energy for it comes through as you're speaking. So it's wonderful to hear on the other side. Let's move on then to some of the main topics for discussion, which are social infrastructure and education infrastructure. So let's start right at the beginning. Just what is social infrastructure? What is education infrastructure?
So social infrastructure has been around, I guess, as a term for probably 20 years now, maybe a little bit longer in some jurisdictions. It is more commonly defined as the bricks and mortar that deliver or facilitate access to essential community services. So it's an incredibly wide asset class. It is real assets. It sits for those that have sort of got a broader lens. It is real assets in our view. Some people extend it out to operating assets. That's not the way we see a social infrastructure. It is real assets. For us, though, it's the primacy to community, and that is that it is typically purpose-built, has goodwill that sits with the real estate that the operators are in, so specialised real estate, and, again, facilitates access to essential community services. There's many sectors. You know, if you looked at, I guess, the lens through which we look, you know, sectors include things like defence, typically run by government, typically owned by government, but there's elements that, from a real estate perspective, you could look at. Other community assets, law enforcement and justice, you know, police stations, community assets like fire stations, you know, those types of things. But the deepest ones where, you know, Arena and this business invests are in health and in education. I guess for background, where we see smart real estate investing for our business really sits on the socioeconomic trends, that is what the community needs and how that might change over time, and then providing efficient real estate capital as well as hopefully some smarts around design that will satiate that need from the community. So that's the way we see social infrastructure. Some really deep silos on healthcare and education. They're two subsectors that we focus on in our business.
Okay, that's very interesting. And I like the definition as well, which, if I put it in my layman's terms, is really property for delivering essential community services. And in all of your market on the website and all of your marketing, et cetera, you see the word community a lot and that concept comes up a lot. So yeah, I think that was very clear. Some of the other themes that came through for me were the purpose built and specialized properties as well for these various uses. So let me follow you in there then. So it's a broad sector, healthcare and education, two of the specific ones that you invest in. So maybe let's discuss those a little bit and explore where within education do you play and where within healthcare.
Well, let's start with the smaller part of the portfolio for us is in healthcare. It's a wonderfully large sector, and there's some fantastic managers of healthcare real estate in this country, both listed and unlisted, that support both government and non-government healthcare services. Australia, you might know, is a growing population base. It's also an ageing population base, so the healthcare needs are significant. It would be fair to say that almost by any measure, healthcare real estate's been underinvested for a period of time. It would also be fair to say that healthcare real estate as an asset class globally has probably been overbid. And that is that we've seen a lot of investment interest globally into healthcare stocks and healthcare real estate. So Australia no different. Over that period of time, we haven't really extended too much. We bought a relatively small asset, $30 million US roughly, in the last half, which is supporting key worker accommodation to a state-based government healthcare service in regional Victoria. And that's the first healthcare real estate investment we've made for some time. We saw pricing coming back into frame for that asset. But it goes to show just how deep that sector is. For us, key worker accommodation, that is the labour force that supports healthcare services in the community, is a critical part of delivering those services. And we were able to get a 20-year lease on specialised real estate, which was accommodation for that facility, seemed to be a great place to put our stakeholder investor money. The other parts of our portfolio include medical centres. They're very large medical centres, so these are not typically what you'd see on a high street. These are multidisciplinary, allowing for ease in, I guess, the first step into the healthcare service for communities and governments wanting to avoid tying up public services. They are corporately run, aggregation of general practitioners, but include things like pathology, ophthalmology, pharmacy and other things. So it's a one-stop shop, if you like, for primary care in the community. So it's the largest part of our healthcare service. And we've got a very small part also in accommodation, but is long-term accommodation of persons needing physical support. That's a specialist disability accommodation, again, purpose-built, that support better outcomes for those that have been afflicted with typically road trauma in our community as well, Mondi. So that's about 10% of our portfolio. It's a very meaningful part of our business. It's a huge opportunity set in front of us. It's a sector, in our view, has been a little overbidden. The pricing hasn't quite worked, I think, really for the last number of years. It is becoming more interesting as an asset class, particularly in an environment where real estate generally has higher replacement costs and you've got population growth supporting the need for more services. So, fascinating. And we could talk for a long time about healthcare. It's not why we're here today. a very, very big part of our portfolio is the education. And you know, the education sector is enormous in this country. It's one of our biggest exports, as you may be familiar with. And, our part in the education. I love it. And I think it's the best part is at the early ages. And that is 6 months, which sound incredibly young, up to pre-primary school, which is sort of 6 years in this country. And that is what we call early learning. Some call childcare. I think early learning is probably a better term for what is actually provided in those facilities. And as you mentioned earlier, we've got about 280 childcare centres across the country. It's about 3% of the Australian market. It's a wonderful part of the education sector. And the reasons I say that, there is, you know, three pillars that really support childcare in Australia and I think globally. The first one is, if it's done well, it promotes better workforce productivity. That is, that families are able to get back into the workforce, families and carers are able to get back in the workforce and know that their children are well cared for and perhaps learning something along the way. The second pillar that we see is economic security. Again, allowing families to be working provides better economic outcomes, and particularly for women. You know, there's some very ordinary statistics around females that have had children and struggled to get back into the workforce because of lack of childcare services, and then find when they do, their superannuation pension balances are significantly reduced against their peers that have had not had children. And I mean, this country needs children. You know how big this country is. We actually need more population to service the infrastructure that we all need. And as I sort of mentioned a bit earlier, we're also an aging population, and the tax implications on the workforce as we age are quite daunting as well. So more children, the better, in economically at least. The third one is an important one. That's that third pillar is better social and emotional upbringing for children. And yeah, we've particularly seen a real focus on this from communities and a response from governments over the last 3 years post the pandemic, which, like all countries, this country had significant lockdowns. And we found that one of the adverse impacts of that has been some poor mental health outcomes for younger children, and a real focus on ensuring that we've got better nurturing coming from our education system, and particularly in the younger years. So a real effort from government to subsidise families into the service, and with the intention of reducing that step from childcare and early learning into kindergarten and then into formal primary school. So, you know, these are wonderful positive social impacts that we're dealing with even before we start talking about the economics. But in a lot of the advocacy work that's been done for the sector recently, it's talked about $3 return for every dollar that the government invests. And there's not too many investments that you can get like that. And that is, you know, an improvement into the economy because of people being able to work. It's an improvement in social services because maybe a reduction in the impact of learning outcomes and specialist needs as children get older into primary school if they haven't had that formal curriculum. So a wonderful place to invest, Monty.
Wonderful. And you've made a very strong case for early learning and its value to society. So I enjoyed that. I mean, there are various nuggets that I took there. One of the ones which stood out is really keeping families and especially females in the workforce, and how important having good childcare is to being able to do that overall in society. Another nugget that I took was you've got a portfolio in early learning of properties valued at over $1 billion. And I think you mentioned you only have about 3% of the market. So this must be actually a huge market, because that's only the property side of it. And there's still the actual operators of this as well.
It's an enormous market and growing quite rapidly. I mean, just from the real estate size, you can sort of do the maths backwards, but, you know, something in the order of $60 billion of built form value as it stands today and growing. And, you know, that's an exciting prospect for this business and others that are accessing or helping facilitate access to childcare services. It's also true that the government is interested in further subsidising. And, you know, important point, we might go to the risks at some point in our discussion, but government subsidisation, federal government subsidisation for those three pillars that we talked about equates to about 2/3 of every operator's revenue. So when you're looking at real estate decisions, if you have done as you should, look at the deep social or socioeconomic conditions of those particular catchments and ensuring you've got the business right, you can write really long instruments, really long lease contracts that will be supported ultimately by that underlying community demand that provides good economic outcomes. So you've got these fantastic positive social impacts. You can also, if you do this smart, efficient real estate capital, smart built form, you can have very long-term leases that can be written over this business as well.
Okay. And I will come back to that point on long-term leases because I'm keen to double click on it a bit further, also from the investor perspective. But maybe just staying here on the educator side, can you just explain to me simply how it works? Do you only buy, let's say, a sale and lease back, or do you also develop and then lease out to these operators? And, you know, who are these operators? You mentioned their revenue split and some of the government subsidization, but just a little bit more on the educator group side.
Yeah, sure. So the educator group in this country is incredibly fragmented, as it is on the real estate side. There's about 9,200 services across the country. They're servicing about 1 million Australian children. The highest concentration is a not-for-profit called Good Start. They're a wonderful tenant partner of ours. In fact, our biggest tenant partner. And interestingly, both the not-for-profit or for-purpose, as they like to be called, and the for-profit private equity included, but also listed companies, provide services on a relatively equal playing ground across the country. There's some underlying benefits for the not-for-profits. Sometimes that includes being able to offer reduced fees, and there's a nimbleness that the private market provide in the for-profit operators as well, Mondi. So we've got a wide spread of those tenant partners. Our business does a lot of sale and lease back, but we're also the largest developer of childcare in the country, coming up to our 100th childcare development, which we're very excited about.
Congratulations. Are you going to be cutting a ribbon?
Well, we're doing something of the sort, I can assure you. I think anyone that's worked through 100 developments, you can imagine childcare developments akin to a very sophisticated, maybe four times the average house, if you like, is the way to look at it. So not overly, these are not large office buildings, they're not large retail or sophisticated in their delivery needs, but each of them come with their own challenges. So getting to 100, we're very proud of. And having done and it
equally
well,
importantly,
well,
generations of students go through those as well.
That's
wonderful getting to 100.
It is really fantastic. You know, if you looked at the impact that we have and we talk with our tenant partners about, you know, there's about 30,000 families that rely on our services each week across Australia. And, you know, that's probably one of the greatest, most proud thing that, you know, we can talk as a business and all of our team talk with pride about is the real estate decisions that facilitate that access. So that's, a primary reason why we sort of really love what we do.
So you both build these properties and you acquire existing ones. You lease them out to these operators. Some of the operators are non-profits, and then some of them are for-profit operators or social enterprises as well. Something you snuck in there is that there's of the segment of the for-profit ones, some of them are owned by private equity. Some of them are listed companies as well. So yeah. I think that's quite different to the South African landscape. I can think of one private equity-owned preschool operator. So maybe just give us a little bit of color, a bit more on that for-profit operator sector.
So it has been by far the largest growing component of the sector, and look, for good reason. For the very most part, that is, even though it's very sharp capital, that is some really smart individuals that are looking through a lens of financial returns. I don't think care has really been lost on that, and you know, there's a fantastic framework for ensuring there's quality provided. There is a very strict regime that sits federally, but also enforced from a state perspective in regards to ensuring quality sits there. For us, it is bare basics. It is everyone that comes through the door, any opportunity that we dream up, that we try and execute on, or is brought into us from a tenant partner or others, starts with a business analysis. And we map 1,300 catchments across the country, which is an enormous amount of data that we've got. We also have about 20 years of data from the underlying leases provide us the business operating data. So whilst we're only the real estate, we're only the landlord, each of the leases require operating data that we better understand what's happening in not just the centres that we own, but the communities that use those services. And from that, we'll build business models and work through what the community expectation is as far as fees. If there's existing centres in an existing community, we'll work through what fees look like and ultimately make a decision about where the rent should be set on a sustainable basis. It's probably one of the key things that differentiates ourselves when we talk to some of our other more traditional real estate peers. We sort of go to conferences and, you know, as an alternative, we've often sort of viewed as sort of the crazy auntie that sits up the back of the wedding, you know, the alternatives group are here. But, you know, it's often you see the high-fiving of, oh, we've got these fantastic rent outcomes and look at our market rent growth and isn't this fantastic? For us, setting sustainable rents over the long period of time, particularly that were drawing very long leases, sustainable rents and business profitability are key for us. And in our metrics, you can see that, and I think any, not just Arena, but I think any good owner of childcare real estate should be focused on what's going on in the business. And if that works well, you know, real estate returns should be embedded. And, you know, it's been a very big part of our business to make sure that we are having the appropriate amount of commerce split between profitable tenants and then real estate returns for our investors, but with always with the lens of sustainability. So look, through that means that both our not-for-profits and for-profit tenants are wonderful clients of ours, that we've got smarts in the business that see what's happening in communities, access to efficient capital because we're listed, and delivery expertise has put us in a really good position where we've seen governments wanting to get more or stimulating more demand, and for us to be able to do that efficiently, and it looks like we'll continue to be able to do that efficiently with further government subsidies being mooted at the moment, Mondi, which is quite an exciting opportunity set for the business.
That's wonderful. Both those concepts that you mentioned, very, very rich. The first one on affordability. It's important to you that the education operators can actually pay these rents over the long term. And these leases are very long. So that affordability is absolutely critical. And the second theme that came through as you were talking was specialization and the benefits of that. And you've got all this data, you're mapping all these catchment areas across the country. So you'd also be really good in being able to know affordability. If you can share, how do you look at affordability from the operator side? Is it a cap for most in terms of as a percent of revenue, what rent must be, or how do you think about the affordability?
Yeah, it's probably easiest to look through a new service. And if you looked at, I think we would probably see something at the order of 20 to 30 new opportunities every month in this business, almost one a day. And the vast majority of those...
Have you received the opportunity for today yet, Rob?
We've got a few on the table there. So the first run past is understanding what the daily fees are likely to look like, and then apply an occupancy number, and you'll get a gross revenue. And from that gross revenue, if anything over 15% accommodation cost, that is the rent and other accommodation costs to the tenant, if it's over 15%, we think that profitability will be marginal. It's not an opportunity that we would pursue. So there's a very first principle threshold test for new business that comes through the door.
And that's 15% of revenue, eh?
15% of gross revenue.
Okay, so the total occupancy cost.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, that's, you know, as the portfolio sits today, this is public information, as it, our last reporting date, that accommodation cost across the portfolio is about 10%. So that is providing the opportunity on a gross basis, a significant amount of the going concern economics going to our operators. On a net basis, it's about 33% at the moment. So you've got, an EBIT DAR for those that sort of follow that, after rent, or before rent, I should say, divided by the rent, is about 33%. So again, from a profitability of tenant perspective, that's sort of margins at between 15 and 20% available post rent for our tenant operators. That's a great environment to be in. That's a win-win for everyone in that environment. You know, it gives opportunity for operators to be profitable. It gives some elbow room if there's some times that are tougher. It provides returns that we're happy with, and opportunity for us to increase rents as that percentage gets bigger as well. So, you know, it's a very comfortable position as we're sort of standing today.
That's wonderful. This topic, right, is for me the single most important point when assessing or wanting to invest in education infrastructure. Is it win-win? I mentioned up front that there's been compelling returns for your listed business. So there's been compelling returns for public market investors. But on the other side, there's also been a win-win situation for the education groups and caring about the affordability from their perspective. So it's wonderful to see that you both are really meaningful to you. Just keeping it at a quite one-on-one or simple level, putting us in the shoes now of the operator, why do they lease the properties? Why don't they just own them themselves or build them themselves?
It's a great question, Mondi, and it's not completely peculiar to childcare, but it is a very low real estate-owned operator environment, and there's only a very small handful that actually own the real estate. Typically, that is smaller operators family-based operators that might have two or three services that might own the real estate, perhaps in their super fund or a family trust, and then operate the business as a company. It is also true that historically, at least, operators have been reasonably thinly capitalised. So they've challenged where they've had good services, they've quickly come to the limits of what they might be able to borrow. And when they're looking at expanding their networks, have found that quite challenging, particularly that real estate's such a lumpy upfront investment, if you like, but also cost through their lens. It's also true more recently that their cost of capital's higher. So, you know, that's an opportunity there for efficient real estate capital to come in and actually assist where they might otherwise use traditional leverage opportunities. So that's it's been quite a fertile sale and leaseback, you know, fund through developments that ultimately have takeouts, but a very clear distinction between operators and real estate owners, albeit that they need each other. They're almost in an inextricable relationship. Each one needs each other to survive. And again, brings with that earlier point about collegiality. I mean, that, I think through that, genuinely, if you get that relationship right from the start and everyone understands what the conditions are and what the options are available, you end up working through mutual wins that means more business. And this is definitely true of Arena, but true of other businesses that work in this field. There is a lot of repeat business. If you get it right at the start, if you foster good relationships, you're in a great position to continue doing more business as these networks expand. The barriers to entry to childcare from both a real estate and operator's perspective continue to increase. That is partly regulation, but a lot of that regulation driven by consumer expectation. So better quality services, more efficient services. That is that we're building really with a very keen eye on how to ensure that labour is at the optimal amount. So there's ratios in respect of how many educators per children. We need to build our rooms so that they're flexible to not only that today, but how they might change in time. So, lots of tricks of the trade that sort of sit within all of that. The benefit of being able to work together in a true partnership is where the returns come out for both parties, and a deep understanding of the sector from both sides, a deep understanding of what each other stakeholders require is the recipe for, or we've found the recipe for success to date.
And the return profile and investor basis. So if I think of the education infrastructure segment, so you owning the real estate versus the investors in the operators, are the return profiles quite different or similar, and the investors that each attracts?
It's a really interesting question. They're obviously different investments for a start. There's more volatility in the multiples on the operators. They're obviously more directly impacted by occupancy and changing community needs, whereas the leases give you a little bit longer runway with some of that. So it's, if you like, lower real estate returns typically, a little bit different that we've seen a lot more focus from investors. So as a listed business that's been able to provide growth, we've had a good appreciation on security price. It's been supported by a great net property income, but also that development that we talked about a little earlier. So I'd say a little bit more volatility from the operator's perspective, and you know, a little bit more turnover there as well. So you've seen a lot of consolidation in that market, where you've seen perhaps less sophisticated counterparties move up into more sophisticated, and a maturity of that sector has meant that you've got bigger balance sheets, perhaps can get more efficient funding, and you're driving a bit of return from that as well, Mondi. So lots happening in there. I'd say the real estate part deservedly takes the lower return piece than the operators typically, and we've got, if you like, it's a lower risk, lower reward environment for real estate as we think it should be, and higher risk and higher returns for the operators typically.
I think that's a wonderful characterization. So the real estate is a lower expected return, but also lower risk, and the operator side is higher expected return, but also higher risk, and those appeal to different investors. I've actually seen this from the other side when I pitched probably 5 years ago now or so, an investment into an education group, which was asset heavy, which owned its real estate. One of the challenges with our investment committee or my investment committee then was you end up with this blended return profile, which became a challenge, and the returns on capital obviously lower than if the business were asset light. So I identify 100% with what you're saying. And if I think it's quite clear to me then what the benefit is to the education group side. We also said then we'd discuss on the investor side. So your investors now, you're a listed business, and prior to that, a private business, and one that has performed well. So maybe just how would you describe what's the attraction for institutional investors to, or the investment case for institutional investors?
Yeah, sure. So we've got a relatively simple investment objective, and that is to deliver a predictable distribution with a prospect for growth. And we
you've said that a lot of times, Rob.
Yeah, I have. And I say it so many times. I actually get in trouble in their business. I say it too much. But it is so important that people understand that that is what we're working towards and what our investors expect from us. And, you know, anyone in our business, absolutely anyone, when they get asked at a barbecue, which we love to do down here in Australia, on a Saturday afternoon, we'll be able to tell exactly the same thing. And that warms my heart. I love that. So what does that mean? If you scratch that away, that means that we should be getting rent cover. We talked a bit about rent cover before. We want to make sure that we've got profitable tenants in there and we don't get surprises. It's also a truth that social infrastructure and particularly education infrastructure is specialised real estate. And we don't want to move away from that. So we talked about that specialisation. It inherently comes with higher terminal risks. And if you looked at the alternative sector more broadly, in the popularity of alternatives, not just in social infrastructure, but it's always been chasing yield. And that's fine, you chase yield, but you get higher yield because you've got typically higher terminal risks in an investment, in real estate investments, certainly, I think investments more broadly. So managing that terminal risk is something that this business, I think, has done really well. We've got very long leases. You know, we've got an average of 18 years unexpired lease terms. We've got a very high occupancy sitting, since listing, we haven't been, I think we're at the lowest point at the moment at 99.3% or something like this. So we're sort of getting questions. What on earth's going on in there? We've sort of lost half a tenancy somewhere. But, it's that data that we've got. It's an understanding that we're managing typically higher yielding assets, but because we're managing terminal risks really well, I think we've been rewarded by our investors. And, you know, as in any business, if you do it well over a long period of time, you know, you get rewarded with what I call trust capital, and that is that they will support and continue to support equity raisings for us to continue to grow the business. And we've been quite successful in doing that. And as I say, the opportunity set in front of us is looking very exciting also. So I think there's an economic proposition to all of that. There's also, and I think this has been growing for some time, is a better understanding of the positive social impacts as well. And, we certainly, whilst it might have come off a little bit in the last number of months, the last 5 years we've seen much more informed domestic and international interest in what the positive social impacts of what we do are. And, you know, that is for us inherent and fundamental to what we do. We've got if people ask what the meaning of our business is, it's better communities together. We spend a lot of time on what that means. Better communities is obvious, but together is in partnership with not just our investors, but it's with our tenant partners. It's as a team. It's with our contractors. You know, the together piece is really important and powerful for us as well. But we've noticed and continue to be encouraged by investors' expectation of us being high on positive social impacts as well. So I think for those two reasons, positive social impact, I think, is the reason we've had good listed returns. That's always wonderful to see. People get fixated on that. I much prefer to see what's actually happening in the business, and the business has had, you know, great return on capital over a long period of time. You know, we've EPS, you know, that is our earnings per security, has more than doubled since listing, and, you know, again, that's the organic lease increases that we get, carefully watching that they're sustainable, but also that development pipeline we've been able to execute on.
I've never heard someone use the phrase trust capital. So I enjoyed that. That theme came through very strongly. Yeah. I mean, trust, it's predictable returns with the prospect of growth. So you're consistently executing year after year, and that's enabled by very long leases. You mentioned your weighted average lease expiry is around 18 years, which is very long, far longer than an office lease or whatever the case may be, as well as very low vacancies. So, you know, 99.3, 99 plus occupancy. Your business was also around during COVID 2020, also around, you're founded 2003, so also around in 2008, 2009 global financial crisis. Tell me a little bit more about this. Did that stability hold or not? Did the vacancies, you know, shoot out?
It goes to the essential nature of the services that we accommodate. We had, like everyone, moments of sheer terror as we sort of worked through what was a concerning health impact to, oh my goodness, what's the economic impact of the pandemic going to be? And very quickly, the government stood in behind childcare, recognising in the first instance that they needed to ensure that first responders to what was a health concern at that stage, a very serious health concern, could actually get to work. So quickly, the government supported the sector and said, we are effectively making childcare free for all families. You can use the service. And if you can work, you should work, with criterion on, obviously, preference for working for those that need needed to be in first responding to the health concern. It was the second evidence by the federal government of coming in and actually supporting the sector. So it's certainly not lost on government the need for a well-performing childcare service. So we feel that is, you know, something inherent in the value of the portfolio that we've got, is that ultimately there is a real reason for being, and there's a lack of disruptors. If you looked at the essential need from government, we've talked about, but you also surveyed against what have been sort of existential threats sometimes for other real estate sectors. That is, you know, I'm sitting in a Melbourne office today, and I would say Melbourne office might be, you know, maybe 35% of people that we hear pre-COVID. You know, that working from home phenomenon has materially affected the office market. You know, going back a number of years or decades now, online retail for shopping centres, there has been disruptors that have hit the traditional sectors, and we, you know, we keep challenging ourselves what that might be in social infrastructure. But the truth is, you actually need the real estate to service to facilitate the services. There's no externalising childcare services. It can't be done in an environment with quality in someone's house. The consumers' expectations are just too high, and quality of services expectations are just too high to allow that. So it needs built form, and there's a lot of regulation about how that built form can be used that really predicates effectively a footprint of real estate that's required. So for all those reasons, I think that's been appealing to our investors, and, you know, incumbent on us to ensure that our investors know not just the strengths, but also the risks of investing in childcare real estate. And, you know, if I may extend to what they are, you know, this is specialised real estate. We do need to think about those terminal risks, as we talked about before. And it's also the two risks that we see as a business: government policy risk, and that is a changing in government policy. I think that's a long way from occurring in this country, maybe many other countries, when you just look at the importance of childcare and what it does economically. And the other one's a simple one, it's supply. So where you've got government stimulus coming in and relatively low barriers to entry, albeit them increasing, you can have pockets of oversupply. And just being sure that you're on top of where supply is going is the other one, Mondi.
Okay. Got it. There's a lot there, and that's very rich. Again, I actually, to add on what you're saying, I looked at different segments of education infrastructure. So yourselves there in Australia, focused on early learning, being listed. Charter Hall Social Infrastructure REIT as well, being listed there in Australia. Looked at Fibra Educa in Mexico, which is focused on higher education properties, and a few others as well, a couple in the Middle East, which are focused on schools. And what was quite consistent across all of them, I think the lowest vacancy I saw, pulling that data over about a decade across any of those groups, I think was around 97% was the lowest occupancy level, so about 3% vacancies. Whereas when I pulled the same data for, you know, office, residential, etc., you know, during the global financial crisis or during COVID, people got down to, you know, 80% occupancy, etc. So 20% vacancies. So I think it has been quite consistent in education infrastructure across different segments, be it preschool, schools, higher education, that it stability and long-term leases is one of the core differentiators of the sector. The other side of that, though, and you spoke about risks, one of the ways I've thought of this is its trade-off. This is a great sector for you if you want a stable return, regardless of the economic cycle. But in really good times, it's not going to do as well, because what you don't have, because you have rent, long-term leases, is rent reversions. So maybe just talk to me a little bit more about that.
No, it's a really informed question, that one, Mondi. And we're in that environment at the moment. We've seen very strong inflation as we see sort of the fiscal stimulus come out post-COVID. And I guess economic costs of new services have increased significantly. But existing stock, that is, existing portfolios of childcare, are sitting on leases that have typically got annual escalations. That's annual increases in rents that have been contracted. Sometimes they're CPI, sometimes they're a fixed amount, and then very irregular access to market rents or market rent review. In our leases, it can be up to 10 years. So we might write a 20-year lease. The first access to a market review, that is a check independently about the fairness, if you like, of the rent versus what's being paid, is year 10. So it's a challenge for the industry. It is not as big a challenge for us in setting up a very long-term business. If you were setting up a short-term, an unlisted fund that had a 5 or even a 10-year lifespan, that becomes challenging, accessing that positive reversion. For us, knowing that it's there and being able to access it, given we've got a large portfolio in bits, for us it's about 9% each year that sort of rolls through as market rent reviews and picking up that positive rent reversion. Yeah, that's a wonderful thing to have. We've sort of always got a little bit up the sleeve given the environment that we've been through. Again, making sure that they're right and they're sustainable. It's a challenge in a market where you've seen such high inflation come through. Economic stock, to give you some data, our average rent per place across just under 30,000 childcare licensed places that we've got is about $3,150 per licensed place. That's per annum. That's what the rent is. Economically, if you were to replace our portfolio tomorrow and you had changes in cost of capital, you had changes particularly in construction and development, that would be about $4,400 a place. So it gives you an idea of just how much the market has shifted. Those market shifts also give you a bit of protection. It means that supply has been moderated as well. Tenants find that, or wanting to expand their networks, find that the economic cost of doing so can actually be prohibitive sometimes. So it's actually moderated supply, but will push up rents, we think, in the medium term. Where you've got the reverse of that, where you've got really short leases in other sectors, be retail or office, less so in industrial in this country, but they do get the benefit of being able to restrike those leases at new rates very quickly. And you're quite right, a little bit, a little bit more attention on those in an improving market would be fair to say.
Yeah, and it's a trade-off, and different investors will want Absolutely. Different things, different expected yeah. return and different risk profile, 100%. Okay, and just talking about the return profile then, I mentioned in your introduction that historically you've had both yield, an attractive yield, as well as some share price appreciation component that has contributed to your return. So just how do you think about it? You did mention that what happens in, it's a listed business, so what happens in the share price you can't entirely control, but how do you think about more fundamentally the returns if this were, let's say, a private business?
So if you broke down the average childcare yield for us, new business looks like a 6% starting yield. That would be on a 20-year lease that had something like a CPI escalation, which would, in our calculation, provide high single-digit internal rates of return over a 10 or 20-year basis. So, again, these are not high reward, but I think they are relatively low risk if you do that right. Again, and I know I'm harping on a little bit, but just the importance of making sure that you don't do that in isolation of looking at how the operations are actually going to run in that catchment. That is the that's the real running that maths and just putting a 6% yield over the top of a contracted number because it's economically that's what it's cost is frankly a fool's game. And understanding from a business perspective from the affordability is what will make good real estate returns.
That's the secret sauce, 100%. And just to understand that return, so a 6% starting yield, am I correct? I mean, last time I looked, the Australian government bond yield was somewhere around 4.5%.
Yep,
somewhere around there, yes. So we're about 1.5 percentage points above the risk-free rate. And how much leverage, roughly, just indicatively, would you be putting on?
Yeah, so we've got a syndicated facility, so it sort of sits over the top of everything. But we're sitting at a leverage rate of about 20% at the moment. You could certainly it's conducive to be putting more leverage on that. But I think we've been rewarded for not using leverage up until the cycle is sort of moving through at the moment. If you're doing this outside of ARENA, you could the domestic banks here would lend you maybe 40 to 50% of that relatively comfortably. And if you really wanted to get dangerous with your lending conditions, you could probably leverage up a fair way beyond that too. Michael. So plenty of
the industry's a lot of stability, Rob. Stability.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It certainly scares me and our business. But there's certainly a very fertile debt capital markets that are available beyond the traditional banks here that would support childcare development and funding.
Okay, got it. Look, that's really impressive. I didn't realize your leverage was that low. So those returns that I mentioned up front that you've delivered, which have been very attractive for investors, have been with very minimal leverage, which in any infrastructure or property business, leverage is generally a core part of the return profile. So it's really impressive.
is, yeah, no, we've certainly been on the right side of, and not just the capital management, but the interest rate management through the last couple of cycles, which has, I think, assisted in that share price appreciation.
All right. Okay. Look, Rob, that was an absolute masterclass on education infrastructure, particularly within the early years. So I really appreciate it and I enjoyed that conversation. I'm going to come back then to you as I ask the concluding question. I ask the same concluding question to all our guests, and it's actually my favorite of all the questions. And that's, please tell us about your favorite teacher or educator.
Oh, it's a wonderful question, Mondi. I've got so many people, both informally and formally, that I could sort of point to. But I think I'd like to sort of shout out a lady called Carmen Lord, who was my grade six. In fact, she was my 4, 5, 6 composite teacher back in that small hamlet in Warburton. Again, faith-based class. She encouraged everyone that they could do whatever they, you know, whatever they sort of set their mind on, you know, you can do it. And, you know, that encouragement has sat with me a long time. And we talk about it with family, just how important that is, sort of, you know, nearly 50 years later, you know, that encouragement sort of sits behind as a bit of a backbone to everything you do. So wonderful question. And, you know, for me, my grade six teacher is, you know, that formative years, just so important.
It's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that story and upfront for sharing a bit about your family and your journey as well. I really appreciate you coming on today. It's been an absolute masterclass. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you very much, Monty. All the best.
Thank you for listening. We really value your support. This episode was brought to you by Education Partners, a leading investor in school and tertiary campus properties, and a trusted long-term partner to exceptional education groups. For more information, visit www.edu.partners. That's edu.partners.